Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. The Reverend Fred Small is leaving his ministry in Harvard Square to devote his energy to climate activism.
This past Sunday, he gave his last sermon at First Parish, a Unitarian Universalist church in Harvard Square, where he has served as senior minister since 2008.
During that time, he's led his congregation to divest from fossil fuels. He challenged Harvard University to do the same. Now he's saying goodbye to his ministry in Cambridge to work full-time on what he calls faith-based environmental activism. And the Reverend Fred Small is with us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston. It's good to have you.
Thanks, Anthony. Great to be here.
I want to start here. You were in Washington, D.C. last week, participating in Religious Organization for Climate Change Activism. And the Pope, of course, has put climate change on the global agenda in a big way. How important is his involvement in this issue?
I think it's hugely important. It's the first time that someone of his stature in any faith community worldwide to make the moral and religious case for climate action. Now, there have been many faith leaders who have been concerned and vocal and active for decades, but the Pope is a unique religious figure, and he has addressed this very eloquently, very powerfully, and especially from the point of view of the impact of climate change on what Christians call the least of these, that is, those who are most desperately impacted by climate change, are least responsible for it, are least able to flee it and to mitigate its impacts. So he has made it a justice issue, not an environmental issue.
Hmm. You're leaving your Unitarian Universalist ministry of First Parish in Cambridge to start something called the Creation Coalition, a faith-based environmental activist group. Tell me what this will do.
The mission of the Creation Coalition is to mobilize people of faith as an irresistible political force for creation care and climate justice. Every religion forbids theft. Thou shalt not steal. And climate change steals the future from our own children. I think a lot of people of faith are concerned. Many of us are passionate about climate, but many of us don't know what to do. Hmm. We've changed our light bulbs. We've greened our congregations. But after that, it's not clear what the next step is. But there is a huge political necessity to make effective this deep concern. The Pope's encyclical is very inspiring, but it's not self-executing. And in fact, in the encyclical, Pope Francis says, unless citizens control political power, national, regional, and municipal, it will not be possible to control damage to the environment. So I'm hoping that the Creation Coalition can bridge the world of politics and the world of faith to make the desperate changes we need.
And why is it so important to bring people of faith into the environmental movement?
Well, I think they bring two things. They bring a real passion for realizing God's will as we understand it. And we also bring a distinctive voice, and that is the voice of morality, of the long term, of future generations. Because we can't, when we're looking at the climate crisis, we can't start with the political status quo and try to figure out what's politically realistic. That's fatal. What we have to do is start with what the science tells us is necessary and then shift what's politically realistic. And that's what I hope the Creation Coalition can help do.
Mm. And so give me an idea of how you hope it works. So this is going to be set up as a nonprofit, and you're going to, get involved in campaigns, put your support behind candidates. How will it work?
Sure. We're going to start as an interfaith nonprofit 501c3 educational organization. And pretty soon I'd like to also start a paired 501c4, which can endorse candidates. A C3 cannot do that. But there's a lot of work that a C3 can do to educate, organize, and begin to bring the voice of the faith community into these debates. We want to use state-of-the-art grassroots organizing, data gathering, communications tools to grow a community of religious activists who can spring into action when they're alerted to pack a hearing room, show up at a constituent meeting, bird dog a candidate, or flood a legislator's office with phone calls.
Hmm. Fred Small, I want to ask you a little bit about your background, because you have a JD and a Master's of Divinity. You also have degrees in law. You worked as a staff attorney for the Conservation Law Foundation. So I'm curious, what do you bring to this fight as part of the faith community, as a leader in the faith community, that you couldn't as a secular lawyer or a staffer for the Conservation Law Foundation?
I think, Anthony, as much as anything, it's about my own spiritual survival. As a religious leader, I always stay connected with the spirit of the divine, with my own inner peace. Not that that's easy. I certainly lose touch with it. But I come at these issues not as a combatant, not as someone who's going to make the other side evil. I believe that everyone is a child of God. David Koch is a child of God. And no matter how profoundly I disagree with them or how energetically I oppose them, I try to keep in mind Dr. King's understanding that our object is not to defeat, but to win over.
Hmm. You gave a sermon earlier this month called The Rising Tide, which I read about climate change. It was very moving. You talked about how people of faith can find the imperative to embrace environmental activism in the Bible, in the story of Jesus, including in one of his best-known parables, The Good Samaritan. So I'm just wondering about this. I mean, sort of finding the roots of environmental passion in Scripture. Can you talk a little about that?
I mean, the heart of Scripture, and not just Christian Scripture, is really the golden rule, that we want to treat others the way we'd like to be treated. And right now, we are treating future generations as if they did not exist. And we're treating the most vulnerable people on the planet today as if their lives were not worth as much as ours. Yeah. Be they a teenager on the Pacific island of Tuvalu who will lose her homeland just by inundation in the coming decades, or, say, an 85-year-old African-American grandmother in Chicago who dies in a heat wave. Climate change, that's why I say it's really not an environmental issue. It is a survival issue. It's an economic issue. It's an issue that touches every single one of us.
Mm. Some of the staunchest anti-climate change voices in the country are also deeply religious.
Yes.
Religious conservatives often don't talk about this particular issue. So I'm just wondering how faith-based environmental activism contends with that kind of stance.
Sure. Well, there's, of course, a tremendous diversity of political and religious belief within denominations, within Christianity, within evangelical Christianity. There are many evangelicals, particularly young evangelicals, who are deeply concerned about climate. And one of the things I hope the Creation Coalition can do is to show that people of faith are as concerned about climate as they are about family values. Indeed, that climate is a family value.
Mm. So let me ask you about your decision to leave First Parish in Cambridge, where you've been ministering since 2008. I gather many in your faith community are sad to see you go. How difficult was this decision for you?
It was one of the most painful and difficult of my life. I love parish ministry. I love my congregation at First Parish in Cambridge. And I just, over the course of the last year, I just came to realize that I could not pursue my calling, and I believe it is a calling, to religious climate activism while serving as senior minister of First Parish in Cambridge. A parish minister doesn't have a lot of spare time, and you have to respond to what people need right then and there. And that can be someone you need to visit in the hospital. It could be a couple struggling in their marriage. So it's a wonderful vocation. It was a great privilege for me to be a parish minister for 16 years. I just felt it was time to jump with both feet into climate activism. Mm. Some people call this an all-hands-on-deck moment. I do believe that the future is not just perilous. I believe that it will bring great, great suffering. And now it's too late to prevent global warming. Global warming is upon us, and global warming is going to wreak havoc. But there is still ample time to make the damage less harmful than it might otherwise be. And also to do this with love, to minister with love and kindness, and not to get just carried away in the urgency and the desperateness of our situation and do things that demean us.
All right. Well, that's the Reverend Fred Small. He's stepping down as senior minister of First Parish in Cambridge. Reverend Small, thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure, Anthony.
Tonight, we're going to revisit a conversation we had with veteran sports writer Bob Ryan.
Bob has spent his entire career, more than 45 years, with the Boston Globe, covering lots of big stories, from Larry Bird's best years with the Boston Celtics to the Red Sox' epic collapses to their long-awaited 2004 World Series victory.
His memoir, which came out in paperback this month, is called Scribe, My Life in Sports.
And as he told us, his has been a life in sports, beginning at the tender age of 11 when he wrote his first column and dubbed himself The Sportster.
I was a good kid with words as well as a lover of sports. The two things I like most in the world were watching sports and reading.
Yeah.
I was a great reader, and And when you read, you naturally at some point want to write. It is a natural progression. And at age 11, I decided I would try out, after reading all these endless newspaper accounts of basketball, of sports events, a little column. And we called it The Sportster. I typed it up on our typewriter. And what it basically consisted of was my overview of the 1956-57 Mercer County Parochial Basketball League that I happened to play in for St. Joseph's School. And then ended up with a few big-time observations, including one about the Celtics. And I said that Bob Cousy quarterbacks this club masterfully. Little did I know I would become well acquainted with Mr. Basketball as a Boston College student. But that was my first attempt at writing.
It's amazing. Was there ever a doubt, I mean, between that time and till you got to college and ended up interning at the Globe? Did you always know that this is where you wanted to go?
I thought I would want... Yes, the answer is I wanted to, but I honestly didn't know that how it would transpire, or
yeah,
whether you'd get a job, or what kind of career path it would be. That part went right through into March of my senior year. I did not know what was going to happen. At that point, I was 1A in the draft and did not have a job prospect coming out of school, and did not know really what was going to happen. And then in relatively short order, I lucked into an interview for a Globe internship, was accepted in the program, and then enlisted in the Army Reserve in beginning of May of 1968. And so my next year and a half or so were set. I was going to work at the Globe. I was going to go in and do active duty, and hopefully I would come back to the Globe, which is the way it transpired.
Mm. Well, there's so much great writing and so many great stories in this book about the Celtics, about the Red Sox, about all kinds of... And let me start with the Celtics, because I know basketball, of course, is... It's hard to say is your passion, because you seem so passionate about everything, but I know that the NBA is a particular passion. So I want to ask you about this great story that comes from your book, the dramatic announcement by Celtics great Dave Cowens that he was retiring. So that was dramatic enough, but it was made especially dramatic to you because he delivered his retirement letter to you. And you call this pretty great preparation to be a sports writer.
Well, it was a singular day. I didn't know for sure there would ever be a book, but I knew that if there ever was to be a book, that I would start it with that event, thinking that this is my trump card in advance. I can't top this. This is the most amazing event that any sports writer would probably have, which is a future Hall of Fame player deciding to end his career by seeking your counsel as a writer, and by announcing his retirement in your hotel room and asking you to help edit his retirement statement.
Right.
I think this is my story alone. I don't know that anyone else has anything to match that one.
I mean, there's so many great details and stories. At one point, he says to you, "Do you mind if I call Red Auerbach?" Right.
Oh, the funny part is, we go through this. He's standing in the doorway, and I invite him in. And what's going on? He's holding these pieces of a yellow legal pad paper, as well as some typewritten stuff. And I start to read it, and it's a retirement statement. And I said, "What do you want from me?" He said, "Well, I'd like you to kind of put it in order, and I'd also like to make sure you get it into the paper." I said, "Well, I can certainly take care of the first one, and I'll certainly take care of the second one. Give me about an hour or so where I can, let me look at this and see what I can do, what I need to be done," which really wasn't a whole lot. And on the way out the door, he turns around and says, do you mind if I call Red first? And so he sits down and calls Red Auerbach from my phone in my room at the hotel in Terre Haute, Indiana. And the conversation was very brief. It's like this. He says, "Hello, Mary being Mary Faraday, Red's secretary. It's Dave. May I talk to Red?" "Oh, Red, it's Dave. Remember what we talked about a couple of days ago? Well, I'm doing it. Okay, I'll see you when I get back. Click. That was it.
The end of the Dave Cowens era. Something else I'd like to ask you about the Celtics. You wrote this about the great Larry Bird. In my career, I have written more words about Larry Bird than any other individual. I couldn't possibly tell you who's in second place, but Larry is surely in first place. So, I'd love for someone who's poorly schooled in the finer points of basketball, how do you describe the way Larry Bird played and what he meant to the game?
He was a microcosm, in my view, of everything that's beautiful and laudable about the sport. Not the greatest athlete. He was famous for not being a great jumper or a fast runner, but he mastered the game. He figured out the essence of basketball. It doesn't have to do with jumping. It doesn't have to do with being an Olympic sprinter. It has to do with knowing how to play this game. He was gifted at 6'9" to be big enough to be able to bring a lot to the table. Where he's 6'5", it would have been an entirely different story. There would be no Larry Bird as we know him, but he happened to be 6'9", which enabled him to rebound, see the floor better, to pass, and shoot over people, and therefore play the game to the maximum of his other abilities. But as people talk about athleticism, they talk about running and jumping, but he had hand-eye coordination that was extraordinary. He had ambidexterity to the max. He's a natural left-hander. He does everything left-handed except shoot a basketball. He eats, he writes left-handed. He's not alone in this. Brooks Robinson was like this. Hmm. Danny Ainge is like this. I think if we explored sports, we'd find many more like this. It seems to be an advantage to have that kind of the natural lefty who can adapt himself to being a righty. So he had this, he brought that, and he brought a mind, a computer brain for the game of basketball to the floor, and he also had competitiveness, determination, all the yada yada, all those intangibles, all encompassed in this one body, and that's what Larry Bird brought to the game. He could see the floor, he could shoot, pass, rebound, and he was a step ahead of people in seeing what's going to happen on the floor, and obviously I'd never seen anything like it.
Yeah, in fact, with regard to that, you have this great description of seeing him, I think for the first time, when he was a young college player at Indiana State. He was playing in an NIT tournament, and you saw him do something, and you looked at your fellow sports writer and said, did he really just do that?
That's correct.
What did he do?
What he did was this. He got a rebound. It was the first possession of the game. In the Illinois State shot and missed. He got the rebound. He dribbled the ball up the left-hand side of the floor, and then about two or three steps before he got to midcourt, off the dribble, he rocked back the ball into his right hand and fired an underhand bullet pass about 40 feet on a line to a cutting guard named Carl Nix for a layup. Oh. Off the dribble, spontaneously. I'd never seen a pass like this. Even the great Bob Cousy, I'm sure in his day, would have been very, very proud to acclaim that as his own. But that was a 6'9" guy who people thought of maybe in the outside world as a shooter, whose real great passion was passing. Had just thrown one of the most extraordinary passes I ever saw. This in the first 15 seconds of the game, on the first look that the three of us had. It was Jason Stark, who now people know as a baseball writer for ESPN.com, and Mike Madden, who later went to the Providence Journal and then became a columnist for the Boston Globe. They're both friends of mine. We had driven out together to see this game from Indianapolis.
Wow. Well, I want to move on because there's so much else to talk about. I want to talk to you about the Red Sox, beginning with the 1967 team that went on to the World Series against the Cardinals. Carl Yastrzemski, Jim Lomborg, George Scott, the impossible dream team, of course. Let's listen to a moment from the final game of the regular season at Fenway Park.
Little soft pop-up. Petrocelli will take it. He does. The ball game is over. The Red Sox win it. And what a mob on this field. They're coming out of the stands from all over. They're just mobbing.
And
Jim,
of course, actually, what's interesting about that bit of tape, they hadn't won yet, right?
No,
they had to go back to the dugout and wait for the doubleheader.
A couple of hours.
Yeah.
It was a different world then. There were doubleheaders. And the fact that the situation was, on the last day of the season, they had they were in a tie with Minnesota, but Detroit was also in the race, and Detroit was playing a doubleheader against the Angels in Detroit. Due to rainouts, they had a doubleheader on Saturday and Sunday. The Red Sox win their game, and now they are sitting around in the clubhouse. This is pre-cable TV. But they did have the game radio on WHDH 850 patched in. They patched in the broadcast from Detroit.
Wow.
And they sat and waited to find out what their fate was going to be. If Detroit had won the game, there would have been a playoff game in Boston the following day, Monday, at Fenway Park.
Yeah.
But if Detroit loses the game, the Red Sox have won the pennant for the first time since 1946. Detroit does lose the game, but they lost the game. This is the one great thing about baseball. Dick McAuliffe is a pesky second baseman. He stepped to the plate in the ninth inning of that game, having not hit into one double play all year. Not one. Man on first. Guess what he did?
Hits into a double play.
Of course, that's baseball. So the Red Sox win. And I was there as a spectator, as yeah. I was for many of the games that summer. Had purchased my tickets about 6 weeks in advance. And I was down at Fenway doing a lunch hour for my job, and I saw that there were tickets available on the last day of the season. I said, well, that might be nice.
Bought
a couple,
imagine
box,
doing that
a couple
today.
Of box seats, and my then-girlfriend, now wife of 46 years, 45, excuse me, went to, well, I think we'll make it to 46, went to the game together and sat behind a box seat down the third baseline and watched that game.
You know, listening to those voices there, I think that was Ken Coleman we were listening
to. That was Mel Parnell.
Mel Parnell. Sorry about
yeah.
that. You're absolutely right. But it brings it back for me, too. I was only 10 or 11, but that's where I first dialed in to the Red Sox. Mm-hmm. You write about that 1967 season as the most important season of your
greatest sort
of,
fan experience
greatest
I ever had.
Greatest fan experience.
That includes
yeah.
anything I had in prep school, anything I had in college at Boston College, and anything I've had since that summer. That was the greatest fan experience. This city, remember, baseball had kind of fallen away after Ted Williams retired. And the Red Sox, in 1965, drew 650,000 people. Yeah. In 1966, there was a surge of interest all the way up to 900,000. Now they're in this pennant race, the first time they've really been in the race after the 4th of July since 1950. Okay, mm. And the town recaptured its love of baseball. And believe me, Fenway was no iconic place in those days. It wasn't what my great friend Clark Booth called the baseball basilica yet. Mm-hmm. It was more like the old sofa at Grandma's house.
Right.
And Tom Yawkey wanted to replace it. He desperately wanted to get
the
out of...
The then-owner, right.
Yes,
yeah.
wanted desperately to get out of Fenway Park. But the people rekindled their love of baseball, that team. So those people that these current owners can never thank enough for creating the whole circumstance that culminated in what they now have. They have to thank Carl Yastrzemski, Jim Lomborg, Rico Petrocelli, Dick Williams et al. For everything that they have today.
Well, let's jump forward a little bit to 2004. And, of course, this is the Red Sox win finally after 86 years. You wrote this in this section of the book, which I loved. When people ask me to choose my favorite moments from my 46 years at the Globe, I always explain that in the case of baseball, it's not one game or one event, but a combination. And you talk about those two great games in the 2004 ALCS, mm-hmm. Boston against New York. The Red Sox were down 3-0, and of course they went on to win
yes.
8 games in a row. But we have 10 hours and 51 minutes of spectacular baseball all played on one day.
That's
right?
correct, because yeah. the first game was a night game, went after midnight.
Right.
The second game, game 5, started at 5 p.m.
Five, right.
So the first game ended, game 4 ended after midnight, and therefore the both games were played and ended on the, you know, ended on the same day. That famous ninth inning, the Red Sox down, the great Mariano Rivera, Kevin Millar draws a walk, Dave Roberts comes in, the entire Western world knows he has to steal second base, he steals second base. And then Bill Miller slaps
one. Bang, play.
Oh, it was a great throw on yeah. a great jump, a great throw by Posada, yeah. a very deft, artful swipe tag by Derek Jeter, who stole many out with that beautiful maneuver, but umpire Joe West got it right.
Yeah.
The replay did verify that he was safe. And then Bill Miller hit the ball up the middle, which Mariano Rivera nearly caught and kicked at. He will tell you
he looked like a goalie
doing it. He kicked at it.
Yeah, right.
Well, then we go all the way to the 14th inning, and Poppy hits a home run off of Paul Quantrill. And then the game 5 was another epic, and Poppy wins that one with a bloop single on like the 10th pitch at bat. But the drama of it. And remember, Kevin Millar kept saying, don't let us win. Don't let us win game 4. Don't let us win.
But you know who else seemed to pick up on that? I may have imagined this. So I was there for NPR, both on Game 4 and Game 5, and I went into the Yankee press conference. Joe Torre was there, mm-hmm. and the Yankees still had a 3-1 lead. Mm-hmm. They still had another game to play in Boston and two more in New York if
right.
necessary. So, you know, I'm still sort of cynical and saying, yeah, it's okay. The Red Sox are going to at least be carried out on their shields, but there's no way they're going to win this. That was my attitude. But Joe Torre looked really pensive and said, you know, momentum can shift really quickly in a short series.
Well,
and I'm wondering if he
respected the rivalry in the
yeah.
Red Sox very much, and I don't know whether he knew, felt he had a gut feeling that was or what, but that's interesting to hear that. I know that I just know from the other side, the Red Sox attitude after Game 3 was, well, we've won 4 in a row before, and it was Millar. Kevin Millar was the driving force, the spirit of that whole bunch. There's no question that he was the one who pumped people up and made everybody else think that it was possible.
Well, Bob Ryan, it's such a pleasure talking to you. There's so much more I'd like to talk to you about. Thank you for coming in. Come back, please.
I would love to. Thanks for having me.
That's Bob Ryan, the veteran Boston Globe sports writer and columnist. His memoir is called Scribe, My Life in Sports. It's now out in paperback. You can find a link to his columns and a link to his book at radioboston.org.
Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.